Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Chocolates are sweet, but they don't last long. Flowers are pretty, and then they're gone. So this Mother's Day, why not give your mum the gift that keeps on giving with Ancestry DNA? Ancestry DNA is on sale now for $99, a saving of $30. Ancestry DNA won't just tell your mum where her ancestors are from, it can also pinpoint the specific regions within those countries, connecting mum to the places where her story started. Ancestry DNA lets us look back across centuries to see where her family lived and where they moved. Combined with Ancestry's massive database of official records, this can open up fascinating migration stories. Who knows? Give your mum Ancestry DNA this Mother's Day and she might even discover living relatives. I know it's possible because it happened for me. Ancestry DNA is safe, easy to use, and completely private. When your mum gets the kit, she just sends back a small saliva sample using the prepaid postal box provided. In a few weeks, she'll receive an email with the links to her results. From there, your mother has control of the data and how she uses it. There could be more to your mum's story. Piece it together with Ancestry DNA, now on sale. Terms apply. Forgotten Australia is written and produced by me, Michael Adams, in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, on land traditionally owned by the Darug and Gundungurra people. I pay my respect to Aboriginal elders, past and present. Every episode of Forgotten Australia is the result of weeks or even months of research, writing, recording and production. So, until mid-May, I'm working on new episodes. For your listening pleasure, and in line with this season's theme of Murders That Shocked Australia, I'm re-releasing two of my favourite three-parters dealing with very bad men who left trails of death and destruction in their wakes. If you're an Apple or Patreon supporter, you'll have full, immediate, and ad-free access to all instalments. This episode includes graphic descriptions of violence and references to mental illness and to suicide. Listener discretion is advised. It's around midday, Sunday the 5th of April 1936, and in the Victoria Coffee Palace on Little Collins Street in Melbourne, receptionist Miss Crooks is a little startled. A moment ago, head down at her desk, she was asked for a single room for one night. Looking up to see the owner of the masculine voice, she was surprised to see a man in woman's clothing. His face doesn't have any makeup at all. He's freckled and tanned. But around his jawline and on his neck, there's a heavy smear of cream and powder. But it's doing nothing to conceal the two-day growth of beard. Miss Crooks keeps her composure and asks for a name. The man says, N. Williams. The receptionist refrains from asking, is that Miss or Mrs.? Instead, she makes a booking for room 441 on the fourth floor. After Miss Crooks hands over the key and watches this Miss Williams depart for the upstairs, the receptionist goes to find her manager, Mr. Horn. But he's not available, so she sees the assistant manager. This assistant relays Miss Crooks' report to the man in charge. Mr. Horn does not like what he hears. The Victoria Coffee Palace is a respectable Melbourne institution. It's been a temperance hotel, that is, alcohol-free, since it opened in 1880. The Victoria Coffee Palace is a place for single women, families and clergy to stay without fear they're going to be exposed to sin and debauchery. What will people think if a man in a dress is wandering around the halls? The ruffled Mr. Horn picks up the phone and calls the police at Russell Street. In the meantime, he sends an attendant up to room 441. He's to say he's just looking for a parcel left by a previous guest. In reality, he's to ensure that the man dressed as a woman is in the room. Yet in doing this, he's tipped off Herbert Copert. I'm Michael Adams, and this is the third and final part of the Forgotten Australia episode, Nightmare on the Night Train. Herbert Copert just needed a place to rest for an hour. His plan was to get out of the women's clothing, get out of Melbourne, get to Adelaide, and then get out of the country. What he wanted was to put all of this behind him and to just disappear. But when the attendant came to the room on that flimsy pretext, he knew the police wouldn't be far behind. His nerves shot, he needed an escape plan. A phone call to Russell Street Police headquarters about a man in a dress checking into a Melbourne hotel was hardly an investigative priority. Mr. Horn wasn't on the phone saying that the man in question was drunk, that he'd offended anyone, or that he was acting indecently. Last year, when police had arrested a fellow for wearing a frock in the city, the case had been chucked out of court by a magistrate. Except on this Sunday, in what was described as an amazing coincidence, Melbourne police were actually on the lookout for a cross-dresser who'd lately been making a nuisance of himself in the city. This might be their man. Detective Constable William Garvey got the job and, with his partner Senior Constable Morgan, went to the Victoria Coffee Palace. The manager, Mr. Horn, accompanied them up to room 441. Herbert Copet had not left. Inside, the police found a man in women's clothing, just as they'd been told. Detective Garvey came right out with it. He said, "You're not a woman, you're a man." The suspect was equally forthright in his reply. "I'm a man, all right. This is part of a joke." The police asked who he was. He told them, "Harry Stevens." He lived in Victoria Valley in the Grampians, where he worked for a man named MacArthur. But right now, he was on holidays and staying in Elwood Street in St Kilda. He and a mate, a Mr. Zolio, had come up with a practical joke. A mutual friend, John Buchanan of South Yarra, was going to visit a young lady at this hotel. The man in the dress told the police and the manager, quote, "And I am to be the young lady in question." Detective Garvey checked the room. There was a bottle of peroxide and a tin of powder. The man in the dress explained they were going to be used to help him carry out this prank properly. Detective Garvey wanted to know, "Where did you get the clothes you were wearing?" "My sister," the man said. "These are some of her old clothes." The officer asked, "What's your sister's name?" The man replied, "Catherine Williams." The man said that this sister was staying with him at St Kilda. For the police, this was all shaping up to be nothing more than a waste of time. But there was a loose thread in what the man had just said, and Detective Garvey pulled at it. About this sister, he asked, "Her name is the same as yours?" The man in the dress answered, "Yes." But this fellow had given the name Williams when he checked in, and now he just said his real name was Harry Stevens. Detective Garvey called him on it and said, "You're lying. You've given me different surnames for yourself and your sister." The man in the dress hesitated and he seemed agitated. At this moment, Herbert Copet only had to say that his sister had a different surname because she'd been married, or even that she was his half-sister. Instead, what he said was this, "Well, you'll get me sooner or later, and I may as well tell you the truth. My proper name is Herbert Copet, and I come from Pialba in Queensland, and I am wanted by the police for killing two men in a train up there a few days ago." It's hard to imagine what hearing this was like for the police in hotel room 441. Early Sunday afternoon, an ordinary enough day. Then this call out to what looked like a harmless practical joke. Now this man in the dress claimed he was responsible for battering two men to death 3 days ago, some 1,200 miles north. Detective Garvey kept cool. The man might be playing some other sort of joke. He asked, "What men were they? Tell me about them." Herbert Copet did just that. He also showed the police a pair of bloodstained pants in his suitcase, saying, "These are the trousers I was wearing when I attacked the men in the train." Senior Constable Morgan left to get higher-ranking officers. While he was gone, Detective Garvey told Herbert to get out of the women's clothes. He did, and he also showed the police officer the coat and trousers that he'd stolen from Harold Spearing. The two men who arrived from the CIB were Inspector Alex McCarroll and Senior Detective Bill Sloan. These two men had been instrumental recently in arresting Arnold Soderman, the serial killer who'd murdered four young girls. Right now, Soderman was awaiting his date with the hangman at Pentridge Prison. Was this creep in room 441, sitting on the bed in his singlet and underpants, really another murderous fiend? Detective Sloan asked who he was. The man answered, "Herbert Copet. I'm known here as Colbert." Detective Sloan asked, "Why did you kill those men in Brisbane?" Herbert Copet answered, "I was at the old game. I was going to barber one of the men when the conductor came up." He told them what had happened to conductor Tom Boys and to Frank Costello. Detective Sloan asked, "What about the third man? Didn't he put up a fight?" The suspect replied, "No, he was asleep." The officer asked, "Well, why did you knock him if he was asleep?" Herbert replied, "I thought I might as well do the lot once I got started." Herbert dressed and was taken to Russell Street CIB for questioning. There, Detective Sloan followed the procedure of handwriting a statement based on Herbert's confession. This filled 5 blue foolscap pages. Herbert made some alterations, initialed those and signed the statement, the wording including that he'd not been threatened or induced to make his confession. Herbert was well aware that Arnold Soderman was about to hang. In the past few days, his story had been all over the newspapers in Australia, often sharing pages with the latest updates about the Queensland mail train killer. That was because Soderman was due to hang tomorrow morning, until a last-minute stay of execution had come through. Herbert Copert knew he didn't have to worry about having a noose around his neck because Queensland had abolished the death penalty back in 1922. He reportedly said to the police, quote, "Up north, you can only go to the Boob for life." The Boob was Boggo Road Jail. What Herbert didn't want was to go to Goodna, which was Brisbane's lunatic asylum. Herbert reportedly said he'd rather go to prison for the rest of his days than suffer that fate. Herbert's confession was florid, detailing how he'd first attacked conductor Tom Boys, then Costello, and then finally Spearing. Quote, "There was only one other left, so I thought I'd finish him off too. I went to where he was sleeping in his berth and let him have it." His 2 murders had netted him about £22. Of this, he had just £5.15 left in his lady's handbag. He'd spent most of the money he'd stolen getting away. Herbert also told Melbourne police that he'd stayed in room 7 at the Doncaster Hotel in Kensington the night before last. He still had the key in his possession. Melbourne police called their Sydney counterparts. Detective McRae and Queensland detectives Mahoney and Brannelly were astounded and grateful for the news, though no doubt they wished they'd been the ones to collar the killer. The Queensland detectives also had to be surprised at hearing the name of the suspect. They knew Herbert Copert, who'd been convicted several times recently in their city. The 3 police officers went out to the hotel at Kensington. In room 7, on top of the wardrobe, they found Harold Spearing's PMG attaché case and the folded paper that contained the hair that Copert had shaved off as he prepared to escape Sydney dressed as a woman. This evidence meant that there was absolutely no doubt Melbourne police had the right man. In Melbourne that night, at Russell Street Police Headquarters, Herbert Copert was formally arrested. The next morning, he'd be remanded for a week on suspicion of murder and was to be held until Queensland police arrived to extradite him. News of his arrest was a national sensation. The Courier-Mail said, quote, "The pursuit through 3 states of the unknown suspect who travelled 1,200 miles in 3.5 days using 6 taxicabs, a motor bus, a rail motor and 2 interstate express trains for his flight has been the greatest test Australian Interstate Police Organisation has had." There was no doubting that. But there was also no doubting that in the end, just as Herbert Copert had been incredibly lucky to make such a rapid escape, he'd been unlucky to front up to a receptionist who was suspicious enough to raise the alarm. Queensland detectives Mahoney and Brannelly went down to Melbourne to extradite the alleged killer. By Friday, they had him under guard on the express train back to Sydney. There, he showed them the Kensington Hotel where he'd stayed and the shops where he'd bought the women's clothing. In the days that followed, in northern New South Wales and southern Queensland, the accused killer helpfully retraced his steps for detectives. He showed them where he'd caught cabs and where he'd caught buses and trains. Herbert showed them where he'd thrown the tyre iron from the train near Woolowan. In a lantana bush outside Mulwoolumbah, they recovered conductor Tom Boy's diagram of the sleeping carriage. The police took him to car 997, which had been kept sealed and in the same condition that Herbert Copert had left it in. He talked them through what he'd done. Herbert participated in several lineups. Most of the witnesses couldn't pick him out because they'd seen him in the dark or in the dawn light. But blue and white taxi driver Mr. Bourne was certain that Herbert Copert was the man he'd driven from South Brisbane to Coolangatta, the man who'd paid him with 4 one-pound notes, including one that had been bloodstained. Woolowan station mistress Henrietta Roberts also made a positive ID. Charged with the murders of Harold Spearing and Frank Costello, Herbert Copert faced his committal hearing at the City Police Court on the 29th of April 1936. His barrister was Daniel Casey. Then a brilliant up-and-comer, he'd later become a Queensland criminal defence legend. He tried to have Herbert's statements to the police in Melbourne suppressed. The grounds for this were that the accused hadn't been officially arrested and in custody when he'd made his supposed confession. Further, he hadn't been adequately cautioned that what he said could be used against him. Why had Detective Bill Sloan written the statement when the accused was able to read and write? The answer, Detective Sloan said, was that it was just procedure in Melbourne. The judge allowed the statement to be entered into evidence and he also allowed it to be released to the press. Now all of Australia could read the callous confession made by Herbert Copert. About 40 witnesses were called. Conductor Tom Boyes was not going to be one of them. He'd survived, but he had no memory of the attack or anything much else. Even if he had, he wasn't able to speak. Tom Boyes was never to fully recover. He'd suffer a raft of physical, psychological and emotional problems for the rest of his life. His devoted wife Rachel, now his full-time carer. The witnesses who did testify included the Melbourne police, a hotel porter from Cairns who'd seen Copert at the time he'd stolen the rail pass, and John Thorpe, whose ticket had been stolen. Railway porter Arthur Shaw described discovering the crime scene, and ambulance driver Donald Smith told of trying to save the victims. Detective Mahoney told of going to Melbourne and taking another confession from Herbert, and said that the accused had told him he was pleased to have been caught because the affair was, quote, getting on his nerves. Detective Mahoney gave evidence regarding the tyre lever and the blood-stained cash. The hearing lasted 3 days and was the subject of intense public and press interest. When all the evidence was heard, the judge committed Herbert Copert to stand trial for the murders of Harold Spearing and Frank Costello. In response, Herbert pleaded not guilty but said he'd reserve his defence for the trial. The Crown then asked that the accused be remanded for 8 days until the charge of attempting to murder conductor Tom Boyes could be heard. This was granted, and after that, remands would be issued each week until the trial. While he was in custody, Herbert had his first visitor. This was his stepsister, who'd travelled up from Sydney and gotten permission to see him for 10 minutes. This visit, under supervision, was reported to be a warm reunion. The stepsister was said to be planning to come back, but if she did, it didn't make the papers. However, reporters did protect her privacy by not disclosing her name. Herbert was described as being quiet and well-behaved behind bars. He shunned other remand prisoners and spent most of his time reading books from the prison library. Herbert surprised guards with his fairly refined literary tastes. When Herbert went to trial in the Supreme Court on the 24th of June 1936, it was on the sole charge of having murdered Harold Spearing. Should he be acquitted, he could then be tried for Frank Costello's murder. Henry's barrister Dan Casey again tried to have the confession excluded. Mr Justice Neil McCrossan ruled it was admissible. The witnesses were the same as they'd been in the committal hearing and they gave much the same evidence. This included the taxi driver and station mistress making positive IDs. A gruesome and dramatic moment came when the doctor who'd performed the autopsies produced a piece of Costello's skull and showed how the flat end of the tyre lever fit perfectly into the fracture. When the Crown case was concluded, Dan Casey told the court his client would be relying solely on the defence of insanity. Herbert Copert, he said, had killed Harold Spearing in a frenzy. He hadn't known what he was doing, and he hadn't really understood right from wrong. To set up this defence, Dan Casey told the court how Herbert's mother had recently been in a mental institution and how, all those years ago, he'd been abandoned by his Cairo-born optician father. Dan Casey said to the jury, "If you should find on the evidence given, and which I am about to produce, that the man Copert, if he did deliver the blows which killed Spearing, was suffering from such material mental infirmity as to deprive him of the capacity to control his actions, it will be your duty to acquit him on the ground of insanity. With those few remarks, I now call Dr. Streeter." This was Dr. Julius Streeter, and he'd be the only witness for the defence. Contemporary references I've seen to Dr. Streeter say that he was a heroic surgeon of the Great War who'd survived a mustard gas attack at the Battle of Ypres. If that was the case, it's not in his military file. Rather, he embarked from Sydney in March of 1918 and by the middle of that year was at death's door because he'd contracted the Spanish flu. Dr. Streeter survived, came back to Australia, became a psychiatrist and the leader of the Douglas Credit Party, a political party that espoused the state giving money directly to its citizens. So he was a fairly high-profile citizen in Queensland in 1936. As a psychiatrist, he examined Herbert at the end of May. Dr. Streeter told the court there was nothing physically wrong with Herbert. Quote, "The first thing I observed was what is known as emotional deficiency." Justice McCrossan asked if this was the same as being callous. Dr. Streeter said not quite. He said Herbert had discussed the crime freely, but, quote, "did not show any remorse or emotional excitement." The judge asked if that meant the accused had, quote, "lack of sentiments one usually associates with human nature." Dr. Streeter said yes, that described it correctly. Justice McCrossan said he'd been watching the accused in court and that he seemed amused by the proceedings. He didn't seem lacking in sentiments in that regard. Dr. Streeter said, "I'm endeavouring to give an explanation of Copert's peculiarity in killing people." His Honour asked, "You're not treating it as a habit, are you?" Dr. Streeter said, "No, he wasn't." His Honour continued, "There is one thing about Copert. He is very much seized with the law of self-preservation, isn't he?" Dr. Streeter didn't agree. Quote, "I think with Copert, rather less than in the average human." The judge wasn't buying this. The man was in the dock accused of killing another person to preserve himself. Dr. Streeter pressed on, telling the court of Herbert's youth in the reformatory and his disadvantages. The judge countered by saying many children pulled themselves up from such circumstances. He could point to the present state premier as an example. Dr. Streeter claimed, "I would say for the normal child it would be a very difficult task, but with Copert, with bad hereditary as well, it would be almost, if not quite, an impossible task." Dr. Streeter told the court about learning about Herbert's autosexual habits in the reformatory, his fear of insanity, and the cruelty to animals that the doctor put down to unconscious sadism. As for the crime, when the conductor had rushed him, Dr. Streeter said, quote, "I think that he acted instinctively, the intellectual part of his emotional reaction being that he rushed for the spanner. But I question whether a perverted mentality of that type, from the moment the guard rushed at him, could have acted in any other way." In other words, Herbert hadn't been able to help himself. Dr. Streeter said that his bad hereditary and environment would have seen him suffer thousands of traumatic moments that had moulded his character. Yet Dr. Streeter was arguing that Herbert hadn't been able to control himself only during a very specific period. That was, from when he'd attacked Conductor Boys to the moment he delivered the last skull-shattering blow to Harold Spearing. And this was a major problem for the defence. Herbert had displayed nothing but cool cunning after the crime. The judge asked when it was exactly that Herbert's madness had ceased. Dr. Streeter answered, "I take it that his intellect began to work almost immediately afterwards." The judge spelt this out for the jury. Quote, "His dementia, I take it, had ceased by the time he took Spearing's clothes and clad himself in them in place of his own blood-stained garments, when he washed the tie lever and took Spearing's ticket." Under cross-examination, Dr. Streeter had to say that he did believe Herbert Copert had known what he was doing when he stole the tire iron and that he'd been planning for the possibility of violence. Dr. Streeter said that at that moment, Herbert had known right from wrong. Quote, "The dementia lasted only from the time he hit the conductor until he had killed Spearing." This sounded incredibly convenient. And what also didn't help Dr. Streeter's argument was that his correspondence with a colleague was read in court. It included this, quote, "This case offers the opportunity of educating some of the judiciary, at least with regard to scientific determinism, and may help on the inevitable conclusion that a very large proportion of criminals," and he put criminals in inverted commas, "are manufactured by the defective social and economic system." So this psychologist politician was using Herbert Copert's case as a teachable moment. In rebuttal, the Crown produced Dr. Gavin Cameron, government medical officer, who said he'd examined Herbert Copert a dozen times and found absolutely no suggestion of insanity or mental impairment. He said the accused had known what he was doing and knew the difference between right and wrong. Justice McCrossan, who had made several sarcastic observations about the judiciary's supposed lack of understanding of matters scientific and psychological, told the court he believed Dr. Streeter's argument was, quote, a great deal of nonsense. On the third day, with the Crown and defence cases closed, the judge summed up by setting out the definition of murder and what was expected of the jury. Of Dr. Streeter's insanity defence, he said, quote, I sincerely hope his form of scientific determinism will never be addled upon the administration of the criminal law of Queensland. The jury retired around 4 p.m. on Friday, the 26th of June, 1936. 40 minutes later, they were back. Herbert Copert turned pale and drummed his fingers on the side of the dock. The foreman delivered the verdict, guilty of willful murder. Justice McCrossan was satisfied and said that no other outcome had been possible on the evidence presented. Herbert was asked if he had anything to say before he was sentenced. He said, I wish to thank my legal representatives. What they did was without any assistance from me. In other words, he knew he wasn't insane. Justice McCrossan sentenced Herbert Copert to life in prison. The Crown said that at this point they weren't going to proceed with the second charge of murder, and they'd also not proceed with the attempted murder charge. Queensland had Herbert Copert where he needed to be, behind bars in Boggo Road Jail for the rest of his life. Herbert was only 23 years old. As it stood, he might serve 60 years, but there was anger he wasn't eligible for the noose. 3 weeks earlier, down in Melbourne, serial killer Arnold Soderman had been executed for his crimes.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Somehow, while Herbert was on remand, Truth newspaper had gotten access to him for an interview. They'd held off reporting this during the trial and then waited until it was announced he wasn't going to appeal his conviction. Then, his interview was front page, complete with a photo of the smiling, now convicted killer. Herbert had told the paper, quote, Of course, when I started as a crook, I never thought I'd end up a murderer. Even when I got on the train at Gympie, I didn't think the trip would end like it has. He continued, I just meant to barber the passengers, and I took the tyre lever not with the idea of killing anybody, but because I thought that it might end in a case of robbery with violence. As for reflecting on what had actually happened, he said, I haven't thought much about what I did. I never thought it was wrong of me to steal, and since my arrest, I haven't thought about the murders. But I feel a genuine regret for the relatives of the dead men, and I'm sorry for them. Herbert alluded to experiencing what sounded like shock after his bloody rampage on car 997. Quote, My mind was a blank when I left the train and started on my flight. I didn't feel any remorse, didn't regret that I'd killed. I didn't think I was conscious that I'd done a terrible thing. He went on, Well, it wasn't until I got to Sydney that I began to feel any nerves. I suppose it was the reaction. I don't really know, but I seemed to be conscious of what I had done. I thought more of it than I had done before. He thought more of it, but not enough to actually feel any remorse, let alone turn himself in. In fact, quite the reverse. Quote, But all along, I was absolutely confident I'd be able to beat the police. I hadn't any doubt about that. Herbert told of how he'd walked around Sydney in women's clothing and seemed not to be noticed. But at Mossvale and on the train to Melbourne, people had seen through his disguise. Herbert claimed to Truth that in the Victoria Coffee Palace, he'd known the police were coming for him after the porter had come up to the room on the pretext of looking for that lost parcel. Quote, I tried to think of some way of escape, but I knew there was none. My nerves weren't too good. I racked my brains, but I couldn't see how I could escape. Herbert claimed, If only I'd had another hour in Melbourne, they would never have got me. I would have slipped right through their fingers. During this interview, which was before his trial, he said he didn't really care what happened to him. And after he was convicted, Truth reckoned he'd said, This will be easy. I can do this on one leg. A life sentence, Herbert said, was a bit like a book. Sooner or later, it'd end. In August 1936, Herbert slashed himself with a razor. The wounds were not serious, and this was depicted in the press as a fake suicide bid meant to get him attention and sympathy. After this, Herbert settled into prison life and worked in the tailor's shop. Soon, many of Boggo Road's prisoners were wearing clothes that he'd made. And as he had on the outside, Herbert kept himself as neat and clean as possible. Newspaper reports about him were based on released prisoners' accounts and on jail scuttlebutt. Not surprisingly, they varied. Some reports said he was quiet, unassuming, if a bit of a dandy, and reasonably well-liked by other prisoners. But other reports depicted him as a hated figure, both for the brutality of his cowardly murders and for the haughty way he conducted himself in prison. In 1941, 5 years after the murders, Herbert sought leave to appeal his conviction. This was denied, dismissed as frivolous. 5 years later, 1946, he was reported to be in the prison hospital with asthma. Further stories of his respiratory problems popped up now and again. On the 1st of July, 1950, 14 years after he was battered, at the age of 72, former conductor Tom Boys died. Given he'd never really recovered from his injuries, his death was reported as him being the victim of a slow-motion murder. Preparing to make this episode, I contacted the Queensland State Archives and used supporter funds to pay the fee to have Herbert Copert's murder file forwarded to me in digital format. Given numerous 1936 newspaper reports included references to extensive police documentation of this case, I'd hoped it'd be a treasure trove. But all that was left was a few pages. Yet these provided an insight that wasn't found in any of the press coverage. It's in the form of a handwritten letter that Herbert Copert wrote to Inspector Jessen of the Brisbane CIB. He wrote it in July 1937, when he'd been in prison for a year. What he wanted was the return of his possessions. He said that Detective Mahoney and his colleagues, quote, know the property I refer to. Herbert was talking about the female clothing he'd been wearing when he was arrested. He wanted these garments and accessories sent to him in Boggo Road Jail. Remarkably, the archive file contains a follow-up document. This was a typewritten form, signed by Herbert, acknowledging that the items had been returned to him, from bra and undies to skirt and handbag. What he wanted with these isn't known. If anything, they weren't a trophy of his cunning, but the opposite. If Herbert had merely bought another male suit in Sydney, he would have slipped out of the city and arrived in Melbourne undetected. By trying to pass himself off as a woman, he'd sealed his fate. Herbert Copert suffered a bad asthma attack in the third week of March 1951. It was bad enough that he was moved to Brisbane General Hospital. And that's where he died on Monday, the 26th of March. He was 39 years old. Herbert wasn't lamented. Truth railed that he should have died 15 years earlier in the noose rather than passing comfortably in a hospital bed. The paper's big feature that week recounted his life and crimes, and it bore the headline, Man Without a Soul. I'm Michael Adams, and you've been listening to Forgotten Australia. If you've enjoyed this show, I'd love it if you could leave a rating or review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your downloads. Doing this really helps the show reach other people. Also, make sure you're subscribed so you get every new episode as soon as it's released. Thanks to everyone who's supporting the show via Patreon. And if you want to chip in, the link's in your show notes. Forgotten Australia is written and produced by me in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales on land traditionally owned by the Darug and Gundungurra people. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.